But we are at Easter, we're at Palm Sunday, so we're going to look a bit at that today, and I'm going to look at it really from the perspective of that a prophecy being fulfilled. It was 516 years before Jesus walked into Jerusalem that it was prophesied that he would do that, that he would walk in, that he would ride on a donkey, that they would celebrate his entry. But first I want to talk about a few different prophecies. In the world of Middle Earth, there was a battle in 1040 or 1975 of the Third Age. And the Witch King of Angmar, he was fighting in the north, and the men and the elves created an alliance, and they went and conquered him. When he was conquered, he ran away, and the prince was going to chase him down and destroy him. And the elf who was leading the elf army said to him, "Do not pursue him. He will not return to this land. Far off yet is his doom, and not by the hand of man will he fall." The Witch King of Angmar continued to live for another 1,045 years. And you can see that if that was you, you would start to look at this and think that you were truly invincible, that you would never be killed. However, on the Battle of Pelennor's Field in 1319 of the Third Age, the Witch King was killed by a woman named Eowyn and a hobbit named Mary. And the prophecy was fulfilled. It's very similar to the prophecy of Macbeth, but I have never read Macbeth. So I chose a story that I've actually read, but it really would have been based on that. And then we've seen prophecies throughout literature that have then copied Tolkien, where there's really a twist or a sleight of hand in how it ends up being fulfilled. The story of the prophecy is actually found in the appendix to The Return of the King, the very same book in which the prophecy is fulfilled. Prophecies come up all throughout movies and literature. In Star Wars, we have the Chosen One who will bring balance to the Force. And if you're really into Star Wars, you can argue who that actually is, whether it was Anakin or whether it was Princess Leia. Star Wars kind of got all jumbled up because George Lucas was in control. He was writing the canon. And then it got sold to Disney, who sort of changed direction. So there's a really great debate there as to who the one is. But the prophecy really drives the storyline, especially the original storyline. In The Matrix, Neo is the one, or he believes himself to be the one, who is prophesied to free humanity from the machines. Ultimately, this prophecy ends up being really just a tool of the machines to reset themselves. But Neo uses this prophecy and the belief that he is the one is really his motivation and what pushes him to fight back against the machines. Harry Potter, he has the child who was born to defeat the Dark Lord, and it was said that neither of them could live at the same time. And it was really this idea that neither of them could live at the same time that pushed Voldemort to continually try to destroy Harry Potter and ultimately led to his own demise. But that story is driven and powered by a prophecy. And then Narnia. Narnia is a very simple prophecy. It really says that when two sons of Adam and two daughters of Eve sit on the throne at Cair Paravel, the rule of evil will end. There is also one about the lion roaring and that evil will end. And both of those prophecies come true very much in the way that they were laid out. There was no sort of sleight of hand happening. Two boys or two girls sat on the thrones and it ended. So I love a good prophecy. I like fantasy books. They're all through fantasy books and how they drive story. But those are not the prophecies that we're going to look at today. Today we are going to look at a prophecy from the book of Zechariah. Rejoice greatly, daughter Zion. Shout, daughter Jerusalem. See your king come to you, righteous and victorious, lowly and riding on a donkey, on a colt, the foal of a donkey. So I think sometimes when you do read, at least for me, a lot of fantasy, I listen to audiobooks, but I consider it the same thing. But when you listen or read to a lot of fantasy, things like prophecies and them coming true can become almost normal, almost expected. And that you have these grand stories, and it amazes me how authors can do it, but they can weave these very complex storylines through multiple books, and it all just sort of works out. And the Bible is a similar book to that, but it's also a very different book to that. That when Tolkien sat down and wrote The Lord of the Rings, he did that over about 12 to 17 years that it took him to write those books. And he released them, and the prophecy and the fulfillment were all in one book. That is very different to what happened in the Bible. You'll see on the timeline up on the screen here that that thousand-year period is really the time in which the Old Testament was written. So Zechariah, he wrote right towards the end that he would have written this prophecy. And then we have 400 years of silence, 400 years before the cross happened, and that fulfillment, I guess really 500 years, till the fulfillment of that prophecy. The books that we read are not like that. They write it and they plan it all out and they have a storyboard, but it is all done within one person's lifetime that they write these stories. And the Bible is very different to that, that it was being written in real time. And the Dead Sea Scrolls, they date that they are our oldest historical document of showing the Bible. And they are dated to about 150 years at the closest to this happening. So when this was actually happening in real time, when the people were headed to Jerusalem to celebrate the Passover, that this prophecy already existed, that they knew it, that it was in place. It wasn't a situation where you could make a prophecy and then fulfill it all in one go. This prophecy already existed. And I think that's what really is unique and what is a little bit harder to, at least for myself, to grasp coming at it from we get the Bible, my entire life, our entire lives, everyone that is on the earth now, their entire life, this book has been sold as one document. But that it wasn't one document. It was actually split in half, and then everything before that was written, and people had it in their possession. That it wasn't that you could just flip 200 pages forward and see the fulfillment of the prophecy. Those hadn't happened yet, and I think that's the really unique difference, one of many, but for today, this is the unique difference between what J.R.R. Tolkien did in creating a prophecy that was able to be fulfilled and put in a book compared to what is happening in the Bible. So this is already existing when we head to Jerusalem. Prior to that, there was this Codex of Leningrad, which was the medieval ages that they had. And that would be why the Dead Sea Scrolls were so significant, that they really pushed that back to were able to see that there was a copy of the Bible and well before Christ came to the earth. At the point where we enter into the story, we only have 1 week left of Jesus' life, plus the time after his resurrection. But we actually find ourselves where there's 27%, 35% for the different books. John's a little bit different. John gives us a lot more after the resurrection. But we can see where there's still a lot of the book left, considering that he was in his 30s and he only had 1 week left. That some commentators refer to the passion narrative with a long introduction is really what the Gospels are. That this is where we get into the main part of the gospel. These percentages come to you courtesy of AI. I did not go through and count all the verses, but if you ask it to, it will go through and count all the verses. The pictures as well are, those are AI too, that you just put them in and it comes out. And so it's going to happen whether we like it or not. So that's where all the pictures come from, but also the percentages, that this is really where we get into the main part, which also very much feels like if you've ever read Brandon Sanderson, his books are like very thick, and it's the same thing. You have to read 75% of the book, and then everything starts to happen. So at the point that we're in now, we really also have sort of a transition. Prior to this, Jesus was, whenever anything really spectacular would happen, he would tell people, don't tell anybody about this. Keep this to yourselves. He attempted to keep a relatively low profile. This becomes the first time that Jesus really plans an event, that he starts to organize things. And at this point, he's very much a hated character from the perspective of the priests and the Pharisees and the Sadducees. John 11:57, but the chief priests and the Pharisees had given orders that anyone who found out where Jesus was should report it so that they might arrest him. So at this point, they already want to get him, and he transitions into, now I'm really going to try to get people to notice me. We're going to have this grand entry. So he sends off his two disciples to get the colt. After Jesus had said this, he went ahead, going to Jerusalem. As he approached Bethphage and Bethany at the hill called the Mount of Olives, he sent two of his disciples, saying to them, go to the village ahead of you, and as you enter it, you will find a colt tied there, which no one has ever ridden until... untie it and bring it here. The significance of it never being ridden, it's never really explained, but we do see in the Old Testament that a lot of like sacrificial or like sacred purposes, they would want an unblemished, particularly a red heifer seemed to always be the one that got pulled out for it, who had never been yoked or ridden. It seemed like they sort of associated that with part of the being a clean or a pure animal. Not all the time, but that does come up. So it could be that it was because this was such a sacred purpose that this donkey or colt would be used for, that they wanted one that had never been ridden. But they go into town to get this donkey. Now, donkeys were ridden by kings in Israel, particularly in peaceful times. We're not going to read all the passages because you guys look pretty tight out there. But when King Solomon, in his coronation, he rode the donkey of King David's donkey for his coronation. Horses, on the other hand, were much more geared towards war times. There's actually a passage where the Israelites were actually warned not to have too many horses, that they didn't want... that God didn't want them to be building up this and start to rely on their own power, their own ability. And ironically, Solomon is the man who rode a donkey at his coronation. He is also the man who built up an army of horses and chariots, went back to Egypt to get them, that he really fell into that trap of wanting horses. But very much a donkey was a symbol for them of a peacetime king. And we'll come back to that later, but that peace symbol of riding a donkey. If anyone asks you, why are you untying it, say, the Lord needs it. Those who were sent ahead went and found it just as he had told them. As they were untying the colt, its owner asked them, why are you untying the colt? And they replied, the Lord needs it. Again, we're not really told how exactly this happened. There's one view that would think that Jesus had prearranged this, that he had told this guy in an unrecorded conversation that, you know, I'm going to send some people to get the donkey, and you're going to know that it was me because they're going to say, the Lord needs it. It was also that leaders at that time had the right to requisition or to borrow animals to use for transportation. So it's possible that they just heard, like, that it was a normal enough thing to happen, that when they got told the Lord needed it, that they said, okay, you can take it. The third would be that these men were believers, that they knew when they said the Lord that they were referring to Jesus, and they said, okay, if Jesus needs it, he can take my donkey. We're not really sure why they had it. There were multiple owners, so these people probably weren't super wealthy. They had to sort of band together. Would think that, you know, if we had, like, you know, 10 of us all band together to buy a vehicle and then other people want to borrow it, we might be like there's already a lineup just in ownership trying to get to it. But they released it. They gave it to Jesus to ride. Through the four different Gospels, they don't all line up exactly when we talk about what exactly the donkey was. In Matthew, we have a donkey tied and the colt with her. We get both there. In Mark, the colt is tied. In the Gospel of Luke, the colt is tied, on which no one has ever ridden. And in the Gospel of John, we have a young donkey, which would just be another name for a colt. But when we look at this story and whether or not it's believable and whether it truly is that fulfillment of the prophecy, when they look at testimony, having slight inconsistencies like this actually make the story more believable, where if everybody said that he rode a donkey and it had a black stripe down its back and it walked with a bit of a limp, and they all said that, then in that case, it would look a lot more like collusion than if when people look back on a story, some of them go, oh, it was a donkey. And then other people go, oh, it was a baby donkey. And then other people go, oh, it was a colt. All those mean the same thing, but it also sounds a lot less like everybody got together and said, okay, we need to write this false narrative that fulfills this prophecy. What are we going to do? And everybody gets their story straight, essentially. It's more believable when everybody is telling the same story, but they don't have it perfectly straight. They brought it to Jesus. This would be the donkey now. Threw their cloaks on the colt and put Jesus on it. As he went along, people spread their cloaks on the road. When he came near the place where the road goes down the Mount of Olives, the whole crowd of disciples began joyfully to praise God in loud voices for all the miracles they had seen. Blessed is the King who has come in the name of the Lord, peace in heaven and glory in the highest. So the crowd yells out again, which would line up with another Old Testament text in Psalms 118 to 26, where they really echo the exact same words as, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord, from the house of the Lord we are blessed. So the crowd during this event very much saw Jesus coming into Jerusalem as a fulfillment of these prophecies. With the Passover, Josephus, who is a Jewish historian, estimates that the population would have swelled to 2 to 3 million people. So there would have been a lot of witnesses, a lot of people who saw this happen, who saw the crowd react in this way, that it, again, would have been very difficult to create a false narrative around this, just that you would have so many people that saw what had happened. And when we look at all of the different parts of this story, it starts to become easier to explain as the fulfillment of prophecy as opposed to a fabrication. Somebody could have said, I'm going to get a donkey and I'm going to ride it in to Jerusalem and try to sort of fulfill the prophecy of what happened. That becomes less likely to have worked. There's also a prophecy in Daniel that really specifies exactly to the day that when, if you work out the math, and I didn't think people would be that interested, except for my dad, in the math. But it almost works out, and it, just because we can't, we don't have exact calendars, but it almost works out that it could be to the very day that Daniel prophesied for him to show up. The timing of this activity, I can't go today and get a donkey and ride into Jerusalem and it align with biblical prophecy. It had to happen at this time in history. The public had to react in the way that they did. It couldn't just be some guy doing it and then go, oh, let's get all my friends to write this down. It had to happen on that day, and the people had to react in the way that it did. He needed to be a descendant of David. So it had to be, you had to be just in a certain tribe to be a descendant of King David for this to have worked. And then when we look at what happens over the next week, that those events, if I go and do it now, even if I can get a crowd there, I pay some people, and I go in and there's a big celebration, there is then not going to be the Passion Week activity happening. He then gets crucified. We have the resurrection that follows directly after that, which is witnessed by at least 500 people, that he died on that cross and he came back to life. When we start to put all of these historical facts together, it starts to become easier to say that Jesus Christ was the fulfillment of prophecy than to say that this is a grand fabrication and that it was all made up, especially when we go back to our timeline and think that this was all worked out over the series of 2,000 years, that this wasn't Tolkien sitting there obsessing over Middle Earth. This was a God painting his story throughout the time and fulfilling a prophecy that he really would send his son to be the Messiah. So we have Jesus the Messiah riding on a donkey, and that donkey is symbolic of peace, which a lot of the different things I read about this would talk about how, you know, he was a peaceful man and he was coming in peace, and they would have expected that he would be coming for war, and it was very focused on what was actually happening at a human level on earth. But to me, Jesus being on that donkey and coming in peace is more symbolic of what he was headed to do and what he would complete in the next week of his life, that he would give an opportunity for us as humanity to be in peace with God. Romans 5:10 says, "For if while we were enemies, we were reconciled to God through the death of his Son, much more, having been reconciled, we shall be saved by his life." That what Jesus did on the cross took us from being in conflict with God and gave us the opportunity to be able to essentially enter into a peacetime with God, for that relationship to be restored. And I think that's really the amazing thing that for me in studying this and takeaway will be, when I imagine Jesus riding on that donkey, that what he was going to do was going to establish an opportunity for peace between me and God that wasn't there until Jesus showed up and rode a donkey into Jerusalem and died for each of us. And that when we look at this prophecy and we start to go, it's easier to say that it's true than that it's false, that if we're going to say that he really was God, then deciding what we want to do with him is the only thing of real importance in this life. Deciding whether we want to accept the peace that he's provided for us or to reject it. If we're going to look at this and say he's God, that's a decision that we need to make. We can't just go, it was just Tolkien. It doesn't matter at the end of the day whether you like the Lord of the Rings or not, or how you, there's no action going to be taken. That if we're saying he's God, then this is the only book that really matters, and this is the book that we need to make a decision. Do we want to have the peace that Jesus has provided for us, or do we not? Now, we have a game of Zonk that we're going to play. So if you are all listening, we'll see. There are not a ton of hard questions. Marion's writing some questions. I tried to make some. So if they're easy, those were mine. If they're hard, that was the Sunday school superintendent. Pardon? Yeah, we'll pray now, and then after Zonk, we can just go. Lord, we just thank you for this season, that we remember the tremendous work that you did in going to Jerusalem to die on a cross on our behalf, to reconcile us to God, to bring peace between us and God. And we just pray for each person in this room that they would value that peace that's been provided, and that if they haven't found it, that they would search you out, and that they would accept your free gift, your gift of being able to have a relationship with God, Lord. And we just pray for everybody as we go throughout the week and through this season, Lord. In your name, amen.